First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that you're here. Let me explain quickly why I'm here and what I'm doing. Some months ago, the Mid-Atlantic asked me if I would give a series on public speaking techniques for any young brethren or even those that are not so young in the Mid-Atlantic states. Well, I agreed to do it at a convenient time for them. And I told my wife before I left Virginia to go to Morristown that if there were two young brethren there interested in following rather a studious approach to this proposition, that I would certainly take the time to do it. If there was only one there, I would take him to dinner and then I'd come home. As it turned out, there were 23 young brethren in the Mid-Atlantic states that wanted to avail themselves of that, for which I was pleased, not because I was involved, but because of the motivation that moved them with the intention of improving, hopefully and prayerfully, their technique of teaching the truth. Therefore, the fact that there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 of you here tonight, two more coming in, indicates that in spite of the hour, there's an inclination and an understanding that this is a possibility. This is going to be a rather loosely structured approach. It will be, to a certain degree, a schoolroom approach. And I make no apologies for that, brethren and sister, because there are certain things that are universal in terms of abilities or techniques or our competence to increase it. Therefore, to the extent that I deem it necessary to use it on a school class basis, I will. But let me make two or three things quite clear at the outset. We are going to attempt in our four sessions to deal with form, with posture, enunciation, pronunciation, standards, gestures, spelling, correct English, a lot of little things that tend to make or break the effectiveness of what you might do with respect to an exhortation or a lecture, or for that matter, a class with interested people. How and to what extent we'll cover these remains to be seen. Because in view of the fact that I'm going to loosely structure it, I want you to understand clearly, and please feel free, if in terms of what I'm addressing, and I'll get into some specifics before we're through, if you have a question that's germane to the subject matter we're dealing with, stop me. In other words, I'm not just going to sit up here, or stand up here rather, and lecture at you. There'll be a degree of that, but if you've got a question, put your hand up and let's have a comment or interchange. It's perfectly all right. I will expect it and have no problem with it. I want you to understand that at the outset. You know, I'm going to be dealing primarily with the fundamental principles of public speaking. Now you say, Brother Bill, does that really have anything to do with our ability to exhort and lecture? And the answer is yes, with a capital Y underscored. Because when you deal with the principles and fundamentals of the ability to speak on your feet, you're talking about any context in which we are exhorting one another or obviously speaking for the benefit of the public. So when I deal with the principles of public speaking, which primarily I'll be doing, understand that when I use that term, you can place it very effectively and very honestly in terms of our ability to exhort or lecture. If we understand that at the outset, I think we'll have no problem whatever with what happens. So let's understand, please, that the principle, and we might say the principles involved in public speaking, hold with respect to the truth as well as in the so-called professional arena. Brethren, there's a single underlying axiom that I'd like to put in front of you before we really get underway. It might sound a little like old hat to some of you, because I recognize that there are those of us who've had more experience, exposure to this, than some others. But young or old, this axiom is still very valid. You see, a public speaker, and even in our exhortive posture, that's what we are, a public speaker must be clear and intelligible. He must be easy to follow and reasonably pleasant to listen to. He must be able to hold the attention of his listeners to the thing at hand and to interest them, and he must persuade them to accept his proposal or his point. Now, I didn't write that. That's a quote from a Professor H. Wallace, who's well known in this field. I could repeat it, but I won't do it. I think you were all listening intently. It's an axiomatic truth. Whether we are presiding, exhorting, or lecturing, we might start our consideration, and it'll be a little shorter tonight than the next three evenings, Lord willing, to attempt to dispel some myth, M-Y-T-H, some myth about public speaking. And I know in the truth we tend to sometimes exaggerate or underscore this. I think it's very important that we try to dispel it. What I'm talking about is this, that public speaking is not a subject for study. That's a myth. That public speaking is not a subject for study. It's quite often asserted that it's native ability. You've either got it or you don't have it. That's a myth. It's an absolute myth. And we might as well start off with a clear understanding of that. The fact is that there's abundant evidence that the study of public speaking can make poor speakers good and good speakers better. Poor speakers good and good speakers better if you study the techniques, pay attention to them, try to incorporate them, be aware of them. There's such a doctrine of awareness, and this field is not any different than others. It's true, brethren, very true, that some few become satisfactory speakers, in our context, exhorters or lecturers, through native ability alone. I'm sure that each one of us in this room knows some that fall into that category. There are such as born singers. Kate Smith, who lived in my hometown for years and years and years, is a perfect example. She came out of the crib singing with that beautiful voice. There are such things as born singers. Baseball players, cooks, etc. On the other hand, it's true that you cannot make a natural, ill-favored numbskull into a good speaker, or a baseball player, or a cook, but with a reasonable portion of brains, with a reasonable portion of brains, almost anyone can learn to be an acceptable public speaker. Now, from time to time, I'm going to digress and give examples, and I may get rather specific in these examples. It'll be for the purpose of constructive criticism, of course, and that light would go on me as well as anybody else. And with respect to the point I just made, some years ago, and he will go unnamed because some in this room know him, some years ago it was my privilege to have been baptized in younger years with a brother who could hardly carry on a conversation. He was shy, retiring, inarticulate, a brother who just almost died figuratively at the thought of getting on his feet and exhorting, much less lecturing. But let me tell you something, brothers and sisters. That brother today is more than an acceptable speaker. In fact, he is a very good speaker in the opinion of many, many people, including those who have been converted to the truth by his efforts. He was a very poor speaker who, by attention to the subject matter, became a good speaker, and by concentrating and working on techniques and the whole concept, became better than a good speaker. Some would classify him as an outstanding speaker today. I know this brother personally, and some of you do too. And there are others who would fall into that same category without any question. There's another element that we ought to dispel in terms of myth. And that's this. Now remember, these are just introductory concepts that we'll begin to build on. There's a mistaken value that many persons put on inarticulateness. Now, did you hear what I said? There's a mistaken value that many people put on inarticulateness. This results in the common distrust of anyone who seems to do anything too well or too smoothly. He sounded too good. He's too smooth. He must be a scoundrel. And we may reject that mentally, but subliminally, that is the truth. There are too many people who view capability. You saw a beautiful example of it tonight. Now, we all know Brother Harry, and we wouldn't attribute that to him. Why would we do it to any brother who becomes an accomplished speaker? Remember now the context. Anything I have to say about public speaking fit into the thought process of a class leader, an exhorter, a presider, or a lecturer. There is nothing wrong with becoming a smooth, articulate, competent, balanced, capable speaker. Don't ever talk yourself into or be disillusioned by anybody trying to let you know that. Just the contrary is true. The better, more effective, balanced handler of the truth you become, the more effective you are in the service of our Master. So let's do away with that myth. There's another one we might mention briefly in passing. And that's this, that a speaker must adopt a studied or effective delivery, insincere sentiment, elegant or inflated language. Of course, that's not true. The more we can understand and give and take in common exchange communication, the better off we are. And we'll get into that. We'll get into that before we're through, God willing, in terms of the four sessions that we'll have. There's something to be very careful of, however, when studying public speaking. And that's this. That the assumption that it's possible to learn to make speeches, or that it's possible to to learn to make a good exhortation, or that it's possible to learn to make a good lecture, quite apart from learning to say something worthwhile. You cannot do that. Public speaker, and that's you, brethren, young or old, experienced or just starting, the public speaker must always have something of consequence to say. An important bottom line with respect to the treatment of this is this. Whatever a speaker says, or however he says it, and we'll reverse this two ways, cannot be divorced from the other. What a speaker says cannot be divorced from how he says it, or how he says it cannot be divorced from the legitimacy of what he is saying. If one is hollow, the other is going to fall flat on its face. So you may have the most elegant, competent, thought-out, exhortive expression, rationale in public lecture that cannot be gainsaid, but if you deliver it in a monotone, uninviting, deadbeat way, people are not going to listen to it. On the other hand, if you're up there making all kinds of lovely, attention-getting gestures, inflections in your voice, the ups and downs, and the proper emphasis, and are giving out a lot of double talk, you've lost your audience. You haven't accomplished your purpose. Now, brothers and sisters, during the course of these four evenings, I probably will reemphasize several points. But understand this, please. Redundancy is not necessarily a sin, particularly when we're trying to grasp points that will enable us to be more effective teachers of the truth. So if I do that, and I'll come back to these things from time to time, that will be the reason. Our 23 has increased to about 40 now, Brother Chuck. The reason I mention that is that I may have to, in the redundancy, backtrack a couple of times on some of the points that we're trying to make at the outset. You know, public speaking, brethren and sisters, is nothing more than one kind of communication. It's a systematic discourse that aims through speech sounds and gesture to add to the information of others, or to influence their attitudes and or their actions. Now, isn't that what we're all about in an exhortation and a lecture? Not only to put across a point, but to influence attitude and action. So public speaking is nothing more or less in its application to the truth than a systematic discourse with that goal in mind. And brethren, whose responsibility it is to think that way, must think that way. Brethren, whose responsibility it is to prepare, deliver exhortations and lectures, and to be a competent presider, must think that way. You don't just with a blank mind say, well, it's my turn. Think about the responsibility and think how most effectively one can carry that responsibility out. Don't misunderstand me, and I'll come back to this when we get into the specifics. I'm not suggesting for a moment that a semi-professional approach to this puts everybody in the same mold. No way. But there are common denominators of techniques and abilities and awareness, some of which we will touch, that are all pertinent and applicable to making you and me better than we currently are. But we will never, ever change our personality. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can use the techniques. You should use the techniques. You should be aware of them. But not to the destruction or disabusing of your own personality. It's the fusing one with another. The three speakers that we have here at Bible School are all very competent speakers. That's why they're here. But you see coming from them three different personalities. And yet all three of them, in various degrees, are competent, experienced speakers. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? And let's understand in our own responsibilities that we must always remember that kind of point. A plain rule, brethren, and I'm including the sisters now in that generic term, please. A plain rule is no audience, no communication. No audience, no communication. In the final analysis, the listener, whoever he or she may be, furnishes the necessary stimulus for any act of communication. The response that a speaker desires from his hearers becomes the purpose of his speech. Now let that sit on your mental shelf for just 5 seconds. The response you want, the purpose for your effort, is one and the same. You're not just going through rote. When you exhort, what's your purpose? More specifics as we go through. But I'm just trying to have you understand the very important premise of why we even pay attention to the subject matter and should, even in the truth. Another truism in passing. The language of public speaking is speech and action. The language of public speaking is speech and action. This fact is very important because it emphasizes the difference between the printed word and the spoken word. 5, I could have written 7, Harry, but 5 sentences I hope you can read the scratch I've got on the board here. The written word, HEISAGENTLEMAN. Now, if we see that written as we do here, we see it. But what does it mean? Let me ask a question. We'll start with this brother on the left here. That's a 4-word statement. He is a gentleman. Say that in a questioning way, will you please?
He is a gentleman.
Perfect. Call him a scoundrel.
He is a gentleman?
Well, beginning to touch on it. He's a first-class person. You begin to see what I'm talking about, brother. This is nothing new. You're aware of it. Common sense tells you this. But do you see the point? And even though sometimes they're so little and insignificant, we should never purge these points from our minds. And when you think about public speaking, exhorting, lecturing, teaching, think about public speaking as speech and action. as opposed to the written word. All right? Any questions at this stage of the game? Now, there's a basic pattern, for an exhortation or a lecture. We'll just begin to touch on this evening, and we'll probably call this session off reasonably soon tonight. I know that those experienced brethren in the group probably have their own techniques as to how this might happen. Those of you who are younger amongst us might be laboring with, how do I do it? Even those of some years' experience, meaning by that exposure to the responsibility, might have sort of stumbled along through no fault of our own in terms of how we go about it. Now here again, to an extent, and we'll get more specific later on, but to an extent, I'm going to try to deal with these elements. In other words, we're not only going to deal with the physical techniques, but we're also going to talk about the little elements and the big elements, micromanagement and macro management, if you will. Now, I notice that some of you have brought paper and pencil and plan to take notes. Do to suit yourself. I would recommend that possibly in the subsequent three sessions that you have a piece of paper and a pencil with you, because a point or two that you may never have heard about before might come up and you want to write it down. So let's launch into some basics right now. They may sound mundane to you, but don't discount them out of hand. For example, when we talk about the basic structure for an exhortation or a lecture, we're talking about making sure that somewhere right up front, at the top of the show, the way the television personalities talk, we have a general statement. A general statement. Now that's true when we exhort. Did you notice Brother Harry tonight in his exposition? How many of you remember the substance of his first line? What was the key word in his first line? I see 1, 2, 3, 4 hands. What was that word? Glory. Now, he didn't define it, made no effort to define it, but he set immediately the pattern in a general statement that his whole effort was going to be directed to, and you saw how he did it. Obviously, Harry is an experienced speaker, but that's the point I'm trying to make. When you begin to frame your thoughts for an exhortation or a lecture, don't ever forget that right up front you need that general statement. General statement is any proposition needing or being susceptible of reinforcement or any other form of amplification. And when Brother Harry started out with glory tonight, boy, did that need reinforcement and amplification. You follow what I'm driving at now? That's a truism. That's an axiom in this business. A general statement is any point that begs for reinforcement or amplification. Then, brethren, you have to have your supporting material. Now, you say, Brother Bill, supporting material, it's our Bible. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But let's think about this a little further for a moment. Once you've made your general statement thought process, however you want to reduce it, and I'll talk about that later on, then you've got to concern yourself with material which will support that reinforcement or that amplification. There are general classes of this reinforcing material. First of all, obviously, is information in the form of facts and figures. Brother Chuck, when he began to deal with the beautiful feet Sunday, Do you remember the different examples of the kind of ugly feet that he talked about? I'm sure every one of you who were here carried some degree of thought away from that. In fact, you probably went back to your room and looked at your own feet. The point is that he had a half a dozen, if I remember counting correctly, a half a dozen different kinds of feet that he talked about. Now, that might have been a fact, Harry, or not. But the point of the matter is the accumulation of facts and figures, examples, we'll come back to how we do this, the techniques of retaining them, comparison, analogies, we use them almost second-handed when we're experienced in this business, but when you're talking about an exhortation or a lecture worthy of its salt, you have to think up front about these things. You have to accumulate this kind of supporting material. What is appropriate? What makes our point? How far should I dig? How much should I collect? What database should I have from which I will be selective in terms of my supporting material to amplify or reinforce my general point? When you talk about comparisons and analogies, some of them can be complicated, some simple. Here again, it depends on one's own talent and degree of interest or experience. But when you think of scriptural comparisons, we had one mentioned tonight. Moses and Joshua. Contrast, Judas and John. Simple and yet effective. The kind of thing that you begin to put into that database as supporting material. Testimony is another classification. Testimony. One of the outstanding things about the Christadelphian community, and I mean this in the most respectful way, is our plethora of written documentation, authoritative material, spanning the whole spectrum of scriptural exposition. When a brother is concerned about an exhortation or a lecture, he needn't really go outside of our community. He should in a moment, I'll tell you about that. But he needn't. He's got all kinds of biblical authority to appeal to and authoritative exposition in all forms. Perfect example right across the hall here in our library. But don't hesitate, brethren, bouncing it off of truth, of course, to use encyclopedias, the Bible dictionary, concordances of every kind, some very good, some not so good. In other words, when you talk about supporting material, don't leave any stone unturned, particularly if you're a neophyte. Those with more experience almost by rote have their mental gun aimed in such a way to go to where they need their supporting material. That comes from experience. But particularly if you're feeling your way, just beginning, or trying to improve yourself, don't leave any stone unturned in terms of the potential supporting material. Another good rule is that a finely crafted exhortation or a finely drafted lecture will use no more than 10% of the material you prepare in the first place. Now that's hard to do, but it's the best way. You will become a master at your craft if you do it. A master at your craft. More about that in a later session. I know there happens to be a young brother. He's getting less young now as the years go by, but he's in this room tonight. He's one of my beloved nephews. And I'm sure he will recall that some years ago, I happened to, in the course of my business, come across a poem under the glass on the desk of one of my colleagues. The poem was entitled The Calf Path. I did not bring the calf path here tonight to read to you. But let me tell you something, brethren. This was in my younger years. It was back in the mid-50s. I was so enamored of that poem that I borrowed it, and that was before the days of the Xerox machines, and I hunt and peck made a copy of that. Do you have any idea how many times I have used that particular poem to make a very telling point from coast to coast in North America? Probably at least a dozen times. In other words, what I'm saying to you is that that particular, and it was exterior to our experience, almost considered extraneous, but I picked it up, put it into my file, and it has been an absolute perfect example, illustration of an outside source to make a telling point over and over and over again in different contexts. And some of you in this room have heard it. You can multiply that by a factor of 1,000 when you think about it and in an orderly way begin to accumulate this kind of material. One or two more points before we bring the session tonight to a close. There are some essential aspects of delivery of a speech. And that really is what an exhortation or a lecture is. Don't think of the word speech in a negative sense. Again, back to the principles I was trying to emphasize at the outset. The principles of public speaking are applicable to our responsibilities in preaching the truth. So when we talk about essential aspects of delivery, we're referring to it as it applies to our responsibilities in the truth. Good delivery does not attract the listener's attention. Rather, it helps the listener to concentrate on what is being said. Now, we'll deal with that later on, too, in terms of certain things you can do that will keep you from concentrating. Point being, good delivery itself doesn't do it. But it helps the listener to concentrate on what is being said. A speaker during delivery should try to be as fully responsive to ideas and their meaning as he is in a normal, everyday conversation. Think about that a minute. There are those who are pretty good conversationalists who are deathly afraid to get on a platform or who change their personality almost immediately when they do. When you're carrying on a conversation, like Brother Harry and I have been carrying on a conversation since we got here, in a brotherly way, needling each other. The inflection and the pauses and the, you know, the little cynicism, caustic elements in a loving way that enter into our exchange. We read that. He reads me and I read him. Brother Ray just got involved in it when he and his sister wife showed up last night. And Brother Ray knows what I'm talking about. It's no problem for Brother Harry or Brother Ray or myself to do that. And when we think about that ability and can pick it up and transfer it to the communication such as I'm now trying to do with about 45 people here, no problem. The inflections, the pauses, the emphasis, the innuendo. A speaker can and should understand that he is able to use those effectively. That's all public speaking is. Remember what I said, it was a form of communication. And it can be enhanced. Platform speaker must always experience a keen sense of communication with his hearers. Now, whether you know it or not, I've looked in the faces of every one of you out here tonight. I'm getting a little old, and my eyesight's not quite what it used to be. That's why I wear these specs. But I'm communicating with you, whether you're communicating with me or not. And I'm reading you. If I were looking at that mural on the back, what is that, an engine? And looking over your heads and looking at the exit sign and what have you, more about that later, I wouldn't be effectively communicating with you. Whether you're watching my eyes scan this audience is something that you only can answer, but I can tell you that it's happening. Any speaker has got to experience a keen sense of communication with his audience. I told Brother Chuck when we were discussing the properties in here the other day, I said, look, the two brethren, and bless their hearts, they're both very competent brethren, who opened our session Saturday night, spent a few agonizing moments trapped by a microphone. How many of you noticed that? Brother Bob, you were one of them. Wasn't your fault. It's a subliminal reaction. Brother Tom was the other one. Both Brother Bob and Brother Tom are very competent exponents of the truth. I know that as personal first-hand experience. But usually, they're not faced with a 900-plus seat auditorium and an acoustical microphone that talks back at you. And for a few brief moments Saturday night, both of them, unknown to themselves, were trapped by that microphone. The keen sense of communication that I'm referring to has got to come into that kind of consideration. And it did after a few minutes. Now, I guess maybe I ought to inject this point again. Remember I said that I probably would be rather specific in terms of some constructive criticism during the course of these four series. I will do that for the purpose of enhancing a point I'm trying to make. I wasn't picking on Bob and Tom. I know how confident they are. But I also know what happened to that mic. Maybe Bob never thought about it, but I did. And I saw a couple of heads bob up and down here. They noticed it too. But more about how you handle those things later on. The platform speaker must always have that keen sense of communication with his hearers. A feeling, and this is why that came to my mind, a feeling or an awareness that two or more minds are engaged in mutual action and reaction. Now, the minute we permit a microphone, for example, and that's simply one of a half a dozen I could pull out, to interrupt, to become an obstacle to that communication one on another, we've lost something. Now, take this audience. I happen to know that you are all Christadelphian brethren and sisters. That makes it easy for me, in terms of the subject matter, even as foreign as public speaking might appear, to deal with you. If I was dealing with a professional cadre of scientists and doctors, I would have to make sure that I altered my communication avenue sufficiently to make sure I recognize the character of that audience. When we talk to teenagers in our own ecclesia, we'd better think about that. I happen to know that Brother Lee is concerned, and correctly so, and has done something about it in terms of a teenage devotion he's going to give later on this week. He's not going to say to those teenagers the same thing he would say to a Brother Gil, or a Brother Bill, or a Brother Roy, who've been in the truth 20, 30, 40 years. What he's going to do is to read his audience. He's going to communicate with his audience. He's not going to give them a canned speech. Do you understand what I'm saying? You always got to do that. That's all part of that keen sense of communication. Brother Larry, when he introduced the Bible readings this afternoon, gave an example of the three little pigs story, which we all remembered, but he used it earlier in the day on little children, 5 and 6 and 7. And he taught them the same thing that he was alluding to in our Bible readings this afternoon. Now that's an awareness factor, brethren. It's an awareness factor. And very important if we are aware of these things going in. We become 10%, 20%, 50% better at what we do. Now this might be a good place to stop. We will take up, God willing, from this point on tomorrow. We'll get a little more specific. We're going to deal with stage fright. We're going to deal with gestures, pronunciation, lots of things that all contribute to enhancing our ability. Are there any burning questions at this stage of the game? If not, God willing, we'll see you right here at 8:45 tomorrow evening. Thank you.